Good morning and Merry Christmas. This is the third day of Christmas. Maybe you think that Christmas is over now. You are sorely mistaken. Christmas began on Christmas Day and it runs for 12 days. So according to the Christian calendar, we'll be completing Christmas on January the 6th, which is Epiphany. Just one announcement for you this morning. The Bagdanovs are grandparents. Just had to get this out of the way. I contemplated whether we should, you know, do this personalization and church stuff, but I knew that you guys just need it. Now, here's the rule. Here's the rule. If you're going to call me names, at least call me the appropriate name. A Russian grandfather is Dzedushka, and if you can say that, then you can call me that. Otherwise, it's Steve, which is very simple. All right, so that's Eleanor Lynn Bagdanoff, born on December 24th. You can pray for Kelly. She's not yet seen the baby because she's been sick. So poor thing is suffering at home, having not seen the baby. And that really is, I mean, that breaks my heart. So anyway, we'll get there. She'll have plenty of days, I'm sure, and days where she wishes the kid weren't around. So come on, grandparents, tell the truth. There's at least one moment where you're going, nah, you need to go home now. I've heard that from you, too. Don't tell me that's not true. The greatest thing about grandparenting is you get to send them home, which means you got tired of them. Just be honest. That's all I ask. There are at least two books in the Bible that are troubling and difficult to understand, at least two. There are two actually very prominent books in the Bible that are very difficult to understand, and alongside with the difficulty, they're very troubling in their message. One of them is the book of Judges. And the book of Judges is I still can't figure out why it's in the Bible. There's a story in the book of Judges about a cowardly Israelite with a concubine. A concubine, if you don't know, is a secondary and second-class wife. So you had your wife, your primary wife, and then you would add concubines to it. Now, don't get too moralistic on this. I mean, back in those days, it was actually a way to survive. So there are some positive things about it, but a lot of negatives as well. Solomon is known to have had 300 wives and 700 concubines. A concubine, again, is a secondary wife. And yeah, it's hard to fathom. There might be a bit of hyperbole going on in there. He certainly was a busy man. But this particular individual, he's unnamed and he is cowardly, comes into a town that is filled with thugs and ruffians, and they threaten him in this town. They're from the tribe of Benjamin. And to save himself and put off their threats, he offers his concubine to them so that they can have their way with her. And he goes to bed while the evening is spent for her being raped by these men and abused. He wakes up in the morning to find her on his doorstep, dead. This angers him. So he takes his concubine back to his home, where he cuts her into pieces and sends her to the 12 tribes of Israel as a protest and a complaint. This angers the 12 tribes of Israel and begins a civil war, which lasts some time, is totally unproductive and devastating to the nation of Israel. And you read stories like this and you scratch your head. You say, why in the world is this horrific story in the Bible? Certainly it's not there as a moral tale for us of how to live our lives. It's just ridiculously bad. And the book of Judges is filled with stories like that. Stories that hardly have a moral that we can pass on. And really, the only clue we have as to the necessity of the book of Judges being in the Bible is this often repeated line that in those days, everybody did what was right in his own eyes. And so what seems to be the value of the book of Judges is this is not how to live your life. And when you X God out of your perspective, out of your vision, when God isn't your vision, when he isn't the lens through which you see and interpret life, this is what happens. When there's no moral compass or moral foundation in a culture, in a community, in a nation, in a world, when everyone does what's right in his own eyes, when he becomes the moral standard himself, his own needs and drives drive the bus, then this is what you end up with, is this sort of crazy behavior. It's a difficult book, but it stands as a warning. It also teaches us how we should read the Bible. We need to make sure we read the Bible appropriately. Not every tale and every verse is a memory verse or a motto that we should live by. Some of those things are verses that we need to kind of pull back from and say, no, this is sarcasm, or this is hyperbole in the opposite direction. This is a warning to us about this particular lifestyle. This is not a model for us. This is a warning to us. The book of Ecclesiastes is the other book that's difficult in the scriptures. The motto of Ecclesiastes is vanity of vanities, all is vanity. Or as one version translated it, meaningless. Everything is meaningless. Now, the book of Ecclesiastes is a difficult book to understand because it goes back and forth between things that seem good to read and these verses that seem like whatever. You know, it's like a kind of a throwing up your hands in the air, this philosophical nihilism that's in this book that just seems unlike the tenor and the tone of the rest of the Bible, and certainly not the message that Jesus gives us. He certainly doesn't teach us that, hey, your life is meaningless. Everything is worthless. That's not the message. But the book of Ecclesiastes seems to grapple with an idea that all of us grapple with, a certain pessimism that creeps into our lives that causes us to struggle, that says, why am I doing this? What is the meaning of life? Why go on? And so there's this book that kind of addresses all of our experiences in that realm, because all of us get there, don't we? Like, I'm just done. I'm done. Whatever. And so this book kind of addresses this particular despair at the apparent lack of meaning in life that we sometimes grapple with. In fact, the book opens like this. I set my mind to seek and explore by wisdom concerning all that has been done under heaven. It is a grievous task which God has given to the sons of men to be afflicted with. Basically saying, listen, if you look too closely, you're going to be disappointed. There's going to be some things that cause you to question, and you're going to scratch your head, and they're also going to cause you some grief. Like the story you read from Judges. That stuff happens, and it's difficult to make sense of it. I have seen all the works which have been done under the sun, and behold, all is vanity and striving after the wind. What is crooked cannot be straightened, what is lacking cannot be counted. And I said to myself, behold, I have magnified and increased wisdom more than all who were over Jerusalem before me, and my mind has observed a wealth of wisdom and knowledge. And I set my mind to know wisdom and to know madness and folly. And I realized that this also is striving after the wind, because in much wisdom there is much grief, and increasing knowledge results in increasing pain. And so this book opens with that challenge to what's life all about? And how do we fit in the evil of the world into this? How do we fit in the madness, as this passage calls it? How do we explain it? And it's a fascinating book because it's ancient. This isn't a new conversation. Sometimes we think that as moderns we're breaking new ground with a conversation about the problem of evil, when that's been one of the issues that's been around forever. We've been grappling with the presence of evil. It's why is it here? Why does it persist? Why doesn't it go away? Why can't we seem to excise it from the world? And so today, I think, is an appropriate day to grapple with one of the most positive passages in the book of Ecclesiastes, a passage that seems to at least attempt to answer the question, a passage that if you're a hippie from the 60s, you'll remember the Turtles sang about, the song about time. So look at Ecclesiastes chapter 3, and we're going to read from verses 1 through 14. Ecclesiastes chapter 3, 1 through 14. And it goes like this. There is an appointed time for everything, and there is a time for every event under heaven. A time to give birth and a time to die. A time to plant and a time to uproot what is planted. A time to kill and a time to heal. A time to tear down and a time to build up. A time to weep, a time to laugh. A time to mourn, a time to dance. A time to throw stones and a time to gather stones. A time to embrace and a time to shun embracing. A time to search and a time to give up as lost. A time to keep and a time to throw away. A time to tear apart and a time to sew together. A time to be silent and a time to speak. A time to love and a time to hate. A time for war and a time for peace. What profit is there to the worker from that in which he toils? I have seen the task which God has given the sons of men with which to occupy themselves. He has made everything appropriate in its time. He has also set eternity in their heart, yet so that man will not find out the work which God has done from the beginning to the end. I know that there is nothing better for them than to rejoice and to do good in one's lifetime. Moreover, that every man who eats and drinks sees good in all his labor. It is the gift of God. I know that everything God does will remain forever. There's nothing to add to it, and there's nothing to take from it. For God has so worked that men should fear him. Now, if you were to read the book of Ecclesiastes, you will find that it mostly speaks about one particular realm, and we're going to look at two realms, or two perspectives, or two visions. And the first realm that is dealt with in the book of Ecclesiastes is what's called under the sun or under the heavens. So an ancient perspective about cosmology, about how the universe worked, was that above the sun or above the canopy of whatever was up there, there was this hardscape up there, and above it was heaven. So when it talks about everything under the sun or everything under the heavens, it's kind of restricting the view or the vision to everything that happens in the world. And there is a sense of which, now I'm looking at this perspective and I'm actually not including that other realm. And that's where the conclusion of this idea comes, this vanity of vanities. If I look at everything under the sun, and if I exclude everything that's above the sun, the eternal realm, then all is vanity. All is pointless. And so there is a sense in which the book focuses in a hyper-focused manner on everything under the sun. And so in this passage, we have these two perspectives. And the first one is really found in the couplets that are here, a time to give birth and a time to die. There are 14 of them, 14 couplets that run through there about the perspective of time under the sun. And you can read it one of two ways. You can read it as time is a slave master and you are subject to it and there's nothing you can do about it, so just get used to it. Or you can read it as providential, that everything has its appropriate time. And when we include the second realm, all of these things that are confusing to you under the sun, now become a source of hope because God makes all things beautiful in his time. So when we introduce the second realm, it introduces a second level of time and an opportunity for us to hope. If you restrict that secondary realm, if you look at life only as material, only as human without God, then all is vanity. All is meaningless. There's a time for everything, and everything has its time, but what difference does it make? So you can look at it in one of two ways. Now, there's some good things for us to contemplate as we look at these couplets, as we look at the reality of our life under the sun. And the first category seems to be an overarching category, a time to give birth and a time to die. A time to give birth and a time to die. These are the two major boundaries of everybody's life. And they are singular, right? Meaning that they only occur once. You're only born once, and you only die once. Everybody is born, and they die. And these singular events are the markers of our lives and the markers of God's providence in our lives. And the positive side is that God cares for us and gives us life and even cares for us through death. That's the hope of the gospel. But the negative side is you're not in control of anything. You were born, didn't have anything to say about that. It was kind of foisted on you, and you will die. And there's nothing you can do about it. So you see how if I look at life under the sun, there's a time to be born and a time to die, I am subject to this master called time. And time is merciless. It is not gracious. There is one sense in which we say time is a healer, right? Time heals all wounds. But if you look too closely, time is a killer. And you will reach that point where time will have its ultimate effect upon you. There's a time to be born, and there's a time to die. Now, I think that the joy that surrounds the birth of a child, that time to be born, is necessarily, if you're going to live a healthy life, necessarily needs to be transferred to you as you grow up. So let me explain what I mean by that. You know, we were just experienced it, right? When you walk into that room and there is that baby is the focal point. There's just joy. Everybody's happy. This is a great thing. When the baby cries, you laugh. It's just, this is great. It's fantastic. Doctor comes in and he starts, you know, doing this with the kid, and you start going, that's so cool. Baby's screaming its head off. You're filled with joy. If, as you grow up, you can grab a hold of the wonder of the life that's been given to you and embrace it personally, you've become a healthy, mature person. That's why the Bible tells us to rejoice. That's why the Bible promises abundant life to us. Once I get to a full-grown adult, I say, you know what? The joy that was present in the room when I was born is the joy that I must own as an adult for the life that God has given me. And anything less than that becomes complaint to God for the life that he's given to me. So when I get to that point, when there's joy in me because of the life that God has given me, a joy that matches the joy in my birth room, then I'm able to say with Job, the Lord gives and the Lord takes away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. Because I have a joy that resides in me about the life that God has given me, and I recognize that it came from him as a gift, and I embrace it, and I want it to have its full impact on me intellectually and emotionally. And I want to embrace that. The life that I have belongs to God. He's given it to me, shared it with me. It's a good thing. It is good to breathe. It is good to wake up. It is good to sleep. It is good to eat. It is good to enjoy life at every level. And that belongs now jointly together with God to me. And that should be joy. That in and of itself should be enough joy for you. If I could transport a person in despair back to the day of their birth, the joy and wonder that surrounded it, I would be offering a healing salve to their lives. If I can take that person and say, you know what, you need to see this. Your life is this right here. It is rejoicing in joy. You need to get there. All of us need to move there. I think that's part of maturity as a human being. Maturity in Christ is to recognize that first and foremost, the life that God has given me is a source of pure, unadulterated joy, a gift from God. And I embrace that and I acknowledge it. So there's a time to give birth. There's also a time to die. It's kind of the flip side, right? It's the back and forth. Now, again, I think as a mature human, mature believer, I have to grapple with this reality that there's a time to die. And as a believer, I begin, the older I get, to adjust my perspective to this reality in light of God's promises to me. But I must. This is a unique time. It is a privilege and a joy to be present at the birth of a person. If you're invited to that moment, it's a privilege. And so on the flip side, if you're invited into that room when a person experiences the end of their life, it is also a privilege. And for a believer, it's a joy. Also mixed with sorrow, but it's a privilege. And I've had so many conversations with people in the hallways of hospitals where they've said, I can't go in there. And I've said, why not? This is the only time that person will die. You will regret not holding that person's hands as they walk through the valley of shadow of death. And guess what? You're not dying. They are. So get over yourself. Get in that room. Somehow we make things about ourselves at these times, right? When it's not about us, right? You know, and you need to remember that when you're in the room and privileged to be in the room, that you want to experience what's in the room and not make it about you. I just can't do this. Well, you're not dying. They are. They're in the room. So you should go in the room. There's a time to be born and there's a time to die. If I could convince people, you people, the people of faith in this room, in the church, if I could convince people of the faith principle that would help them at their death and through their death for you to die well, I will have done my job and fulfill my calling as your pastor. There's a time to give birth. There's a time to die. These pictures are the kind of the overarching that governs the rest of this passage. There's 14 couplets. We're not going to go through all of them. The next three pairs deal with various creative and destructive activities in life. There's a time to plant, a time to uproot what's planted. So it's kind of the farming thing. There's a time to do both. But it's kind of funny. It doesn't say a time to plant and a time to reap, or time to sow and reap. It says a time to plant and a time to uproot what's planted. It seems to be talking again about the birth and death cycle. So think of a tree, right? It's time to cut that tree down. It's done. It's done its duty. It's done. We've got to cut it down. And there's a time for both of those things, a time to kill and a time to heal. And in an older culture like that, those are very real kinds of things that we kind of distance ourselves with here. Time to tear up and a time to build up. So those are the next pairs. The next two couplets after that kind of deal with the private and public expression of emotion. A time to weep and a time to laugh. A time to mourn and a time to dance. And there are times in life where we have to express both those things, sometimes together. Christmas is like that, right? So this Christmas, we're thrilled. It's great Christmas, new baby. And then you come to celebrate Christmas and you remember, you know, mom's not here, right? And so you have sorrow and joy mixed together. For us, we're celebrating the birth of a grandchild. Today, Joanne and the provost are bearing her mother. So you have these connect points of weeping and laughing, and they sometimes overlap. Mourning and dancing relate to the more public expressions of these emotions. At a funeral, we mourn together. At a wedding, we dance together. Right? So last weekend we had a wedding here at the church and people were dancing. And today, as I mentioned, it's not here, but Joanne's family will be mourning. And we will mourn together with her as we remember or even join her in that mourning. And sometimes as Christians, we tend to kind of blur the lines here. And I would encourage you not to. So here's my illustration. And I'm not telling you not to do this, but sometimes what we'll do is we'll call funerals a celebration of life, right? And I think there's an element of a funeral that has to have that part of it. We want to remember the life. But a funeral is a funeral. And it is appropriate for you to cry and to mourn the loss. And you should reserve a boundary for that. This is a time for mourning. You know, oftentimes you say, Uncle Joe, you know, he doesn't want anybody to cry at his funeral. He wants it to be happy. Well, guess what, Uncle Joe? We miss you, and it's not happy. And that's okay. And we'll be happy when we remember you. And there'll be laughter at your funeral. But you know what? We're going to cry at your funeral too. Because it's a funeral. It's a time to mourn. It's not that Christians shouldn't mourn. The Bible doesn't say we shouldn't mourn. It encourages us to mourn. It just tells us that our mourning is informed by our faith. We don't mourn like those who have no hope. We mourn differently. We mourn as people who have hope. Our faith doesn't remove weeping and mourning from our emotional lexicon. Rather, it defines and refines its meaning. The next couplets deal with a time to throw stones and a time to gather stones, and I have no idea what this means. Seriously, if you read commentators, the ideas about what this might mean range from everything from war to sabotaging your neighbor's farm to sex. No kidding. So essentially, this idea has kind of got lost in history. We don't really kind of know exactly what's being referred to here. I just think it's one of the Ecclesiastes for kids. You know, you tell your kids, yeah, hey, there's time to throw stones and time to gather them. You know, just go play in the yard. That's the best I can come up with. The next three couplets, or the next couplet, has to do with personal relationships, a time to embrace, and a time to shun embracing. Relationships are not singular either. There's appropriate times for different behaviors in relationships. And then there's some encouragements about possessions, a time to search, a time to give up as lost. Yeah, have you ever had that? It's time to stop looking for that. Just go buy a new one. It's only $10. It'll be okay. Just count it as lost. Let it go. You'll be okay. A time to keep and a time to throw away, right? Your clothes in that closet that you haven't worn for over a year, let them go, right? A time to tear apart, a time to sew together. Again, a culture that actually did their own making of clothes. You can see where they might take something and say, I don't need this garment anymore, but I need this material for this. And they would reuse it. And then finally, a couplet on speech, time to be silent and a time to speak, right? So aren't you going to say something? You've said that to people, right? You need to say something right now, and you need to shut up, right? So we get those. And then finally, again, kind of this ultimate personal and corporate relational context, a time to love and a time to hate. We could talk a long time about that. A time for peace and a time for war. So that's the perspective under the sun, that these things happen. There's an appropriate time for all of them. But we don't want to just restrict our vision to underneath the sun. We want to expand it and include that second realm. We want to include eternity in our perspective and in our vision. And this begins to help us to make sense of everything. And so there's five principles I want to leave you with as we kind of close this up this morning that have to do with eternity. And the first one is found in verse 11. My version says he's made everything appropriate in its time. I think that's not a great translation. The bulk of all the other translations, the ones that I don't use, say that God makes all things beautiful in his time. And that's a much preferable term to put in here. When you incorporate the concept of God into this picture, it's now expanding our box. And we begin to see the things that I don't understand, God is going to make them beautiful. This idea is grounded in the character of God, who is good. Worship will help you return again and again to this foundational character, which should drive your vision of God. He is good. He is good, and he makes all things beautiful by his power. Now, I don't know if you remember these little games, puzzles, but there's this one puzzle. There's a box. Inside the box, there's four dots. The two on this side are like this. The two on this side are like this, right? And the trick is to draw two lines connecting all four dots. Don't raise your pencil, right? And if you keep looking at this puzzle in the box, there's no way to do it. You can't do it. The only way to connect all four of those dots is to draw the line so that it extends out beyond the box. And then you can connect them. And this is the picture that we're trying to paint here, is that these times for all these different things don't make sense. They lead us to despair if we exclude the second realm, if our box is too small. God makes all things beautiful in its time. The New Testament repeats it, right? You've memorized this verse, hopefully, Romans 8:28. You know which verse I'm talking about? We know that God causes all things to work together for good to those who love him and are called according to his purpose. God is the one who does that. There are other verses that speak about God who works all things according to the counsel of his will. That's expanding the box to say, I don't know how these things fit together, but God does. And not only does he know how they fit together, he is making them beautiful. I don't know how that works. I'm not sure how that's going to be all pieced together, but I'm going to trust this verse. This truth. I'm going to lean on this truth. It's going to frame my vision. When I sing, Be Thou My Vision again, that's what I'm going to think about. That, man, you make all things good. I'm going to trust you for that. I think Christians have given up on this principle. I think it's a memory verse only, but it's not something that we extend into our lives much beyond the doors of the church. We've looked around and we've agreed with the narrator in the book of Ecclesiastes. What's the point? Everything's going to hell in a handbasket anyway. Here's the ruling principle of providence, the providence of God, who makes all things beautiful in his time. He rules time. He is the sovereign God of the universe. Jesus is the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords. He isn't going to redeem all things. He redeemed all things at the cross. He will build his church, he promises. He has risen from the dead. He will fulfill his creative purposes so that the earth and all that is in it will be good again. But we don't believe this. We've let our culture and our perspective or our culture determine our perspective and our attitude. And contrary to every sign the scripture teaches us, we believe that the devil's in control and that God is up there wringing his hands because, man, just can't, I mean, it's just not coming together. Pessimism has become our middle name, contrary to fact and reality and biblical revelation. I've been on a mission for the last 10 years, if you've been around me for any length of time, to counter a dominant idea that rules in modern American Christianity. And that idea is that the world is getting worse and worse. So if you've been around me any length of time, we've had this argument. And you've done this to me, as this is what everybody does to me. What I get from people is this range of responses. They either dismiss me, or they just consider me a madman. You're just crazy. That's just crazy talk. That's just Steve. There he goes again. It doesn't matter if I run out any number of statistics that demonstrate that in every category there is a diminishing of violence, poverty, and there is an increase in the quality and length of life on our planet. And yet we remain addicted to an unbiblical and non-factual worldview. Here's what the scriptures say. In spite of everything that we see, everything under the sun, God makes all things beautiful in his time. And I have news for you. He's already doing it. And you need to begin to look through the lens of that verse and that truth. You know, the Bible says there's a time for war and a time for peace. But I think we think there's never really a time for peace because war is inevitable. It's never going to end. Okay. But that's your perspective, not the Bible's perspective. That's your view, not the Bible's promise. So make your memory verse for 2016. God makes all things beautiful in his time. And begin to look outside of the walls of these church and your home and begin to see where God is working and making things beautiful. And don't let despair and apparent victories of evil diminish your faith in the truth of the gospel and the truth of the scriptures and its promises. Because number two, God has set eternity in our hearts. So God makes all things beautiful, and he has set eternity in our hearts. Augustine put it this way: you have made us for yourself, and our hearts are restless until they find peace in you. And this is the call of the gospel, right? That God has set eternity in the hearts of man, and the job of the church and the believer is to light a fire in that heart that says, you know what, it's already there. Eternity already rests in your hearts. Here's the clincher about eternity in your hearts. Here's how you know that eternity is in your hearts. Because you constantly ask the why question. And the why question moves you out of realm number one into realm number two. And without realm number two, the why question is Ecclesiastes' answer, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. But when eternity is in your hearts, then you have the answer to the why question, but not the details. And so the second part of this verse, verse 11, says, he has set eternity in their heart, yet so that man will not find out the work which God has done from the beginning even to the end. Isn't it funny? God does not give you the answers, right? He says, you trust me. I got it covered. It's the classic kids in the car, dad, where are we going? And you say, don't worry about it. I got it. What was really irritating is when my kids got to 10, 11, and 12 and started telling me which way I should go. Right? And that's kind of what we're doing. God hasn't called us to know all the answers about the beginning or the end. He said, you know what? You trust me. The third thing. It's a great phrase here in verse 12. I know there is nothing better than to rejoice and to do good in one's lifetime. In spite of all the questions you might have, the issues of time and eternity, the issues of why did this happen and why is this happening and what's going to come next, here is a foundational phrase. Here's something worth living your life by. Listen, just keep it simple. I know this. There's nothing better than to rejoice and to do good. And that's what you should focus on. We can talk about these questions till the cows come home at Denny's while you buy me burgers all the time. But ultimately, when we wake up in the morning, rejoice and do good. And repeat that every day. And it'll reap for you a harvest that eternally is blessing not only you, but God and others. Again, there's another phrase in this passage that says, I know that everything that God does remains forever. So even though it seems like the things that I do just really don't have any meaning, when God is a part of it, when I join God and he joins me in my efforts, those things now become a crown that lasts forever, right? They become substantive. When my treasure is in heaven, moth and rust don't destroy it. So you see, again, that's a marvelous principle. And then finally, the ultimate life principle, the ultimate life principle in the book of Ecclesiastes, and it's funny how it's written. It's filled with despair, and it's filled with all this negative vanity as vanities. And then the very end of the book, the last two verses give you the key. And really, those are the only two verses really worth reading in the whole book. Ecclesiastes chapter 12, verses 13 and 14 says, fear God when all has been heard. Fear God and keep his commandments, because this applies to every person. For God will bring every act to judgment, everything which is hidden, whether good or evil. And that's the bottom line. So today, this week, just traditionally we tend to do this, we reflect. When you think back on 2015 and even extend it back further and further, and you examine your life and you think about all that's gone on, all that's happened, you might be tempted to despair. What was the point? I wanted my life to be something different, something better, something bigger, right? You need to put on the lens of the fear of God, and you need to look back with that second realm dominating your vision. And you need to rejoice that God has given you life. And along the way, there have been marvelous things that have come your way. That in the living of life, God has been gracious to you, and God has given you marvelous blessings, and you need to celebrate those things. That's what we do in worship. And when you look ahead and you say, I don't know what's coming. I don't know. I could die this year. I don't know. But I know that God has the future in his hands, and he loves me, and he cares for me. And so I'm going to be hopeful about the future. And the bottom line is, right, this is what Jesus told us. Hey, don't worry about tomorrow. It has enough trouble of its own. You just focus on today. And remember, God cares for you more than he cares for the sparrows and the grass and everything else. He loves you. And he's present with you. And as you examine your time, make sure that you examine it fully with both realms in mind. So, Father, we're grateful for you and for Jesus for this Christmas season, for the hope of the gospel, that you've not left us alone, that your Spirit is with us and loves us and cares for us, that you'll never leave us or forsake us, that you've given us your Son. It should tell us that you wouldn't withhold anything from us, that you're a good God, and that we should trust in your goodness and your power and your strength and your purpose. That, Lord, when we look around and we become overwhelmed with the evil that we see in the world, that we should begin to reframe our vision with the God of the universe in mind, with the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords in mind, with Jesus Christ, the risen and ascended Savior, in mind. And so, Lord, may we be bold in igniting the eternity that resides in the hearts of men that you've planted there. And may we ignite it so that they see the truth of Jesus Christ and are filled with hope, filled with love. And may we pursue the peace that is promised at Christmas within ourselves, between you and us, amongst ourselves in this community. And Lord, I just pray that we would pray for that globally. And pray, Lord, that your will would be done on earth as it is in heaven. And we're grateful for life and another year. And because of Jesus, we give you praise. Amen.